Welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians and social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
So I'd like to start with a few quotations or statistics just to kind of prime the conversation from. The first, and what I'm going to ask you to do is see if you can identify who offered this quote and when was this quote made. Of all forms of inequality, injustice in healthcare reform is the most shocking and inhumane. Now, who do you think is the author of that quote and in what year? I haven't yet, when I've done this presentation, had anyone jump on this one. It certainly surprised me. Yes,
Truman.
No, but I like that thought. Martin Luther King Jr., 1963, with his letter from Birmingham Jail. Very interesting. Here's a statistic from the Institute of Medicine. How many preventable deaths on average occur each year in the U.S. because of the lack of affordable health care? Ventures? I was surprised. Oh, I don't have it here. 18,000. So every year, 18,000 people die in the U.S., which could be prevented if they had affordable health care offered to them. So related to that, another statistic. Since the last major effort to bring about health care reform, do you remember the last major political effort to bring about health care reform? The Clinton administration, about 1994. So between 1994 and today, about how many people in the U.S. have died because of lack to affordable health care? It's kind of a math problem. 18,000 times.
Yeah.
But it's over 250,000. So again, part of, discussions of health care is to bridge the gap between it being very theoretical and something that's sort of at policy level and bring home to their real implications in terms of the lives, or in this case, the deaths of people in our society. And it's important to keep that in mind. This isn't just an abstract discussion. Real people are impacted in real ways. A fourth quote. Although America leads the world in spending in healthcare cumulatively, we're still the only wealthy industrialized nation that does not ensure that all of our citizens have healthcare coverage. So it's a unique aspect of being the United States. We're the only industrialized country at this point in time that doesn't provide health care to all citizens. And that's from the Institute of Medicine. And then the last quote I'd like to make is from the Conference of Catholic Bishops that was made back in March of 2012. This quote said, "Congress should base decisions on the federal budget, and for the purposes of this discussion, I'm going to say, should base decisions about health care, because certainly that's an important piece of the federal budget. So Congress should base decisions about health care on the criteria of whether they protect or threaten human life and dignity, whether they put first the needs of the hungry and homeless and the unemployed, whether they reflect the shared responsibility of government and other institutions to promote the common good of all, and especially workers and families who struggle to live in dignity and difficult economic times." So a sense of what's one of the criteria that we'll want to use when evaluating federal budget. And that's from the Conference on Catholic Bishops in March of 2012. Now, there's been a number of opinion polls that have been done that basically ask who wants health care reform to occur in the country. And by and large, almost everyone says we want to see healthcare reform happen. Obviously, it means very different things to different people. The divisive piece of it is how are we going to get there and how are we going to pay for it? Put another way, healthcare reform is less about the desired outcomes of healthcare reform, but on the strategies that we need to put in place in order to get there. There's actually a fairly large agreed upon set of outcomes with regard to healthcare that folks from the left and the right, Republicans, Democrats, will tend to agree when surveys are taken. The first is that all individuals and families should have health care. In surveys, almost everyone says that would be an ideal goal. Secondly, health care coverage should be continuous. meaning it should cover from birth to death. There should be no gaps in healthcare coverage. Third, healthcare coverage should be affordable to individuals and families. And typically when we talk about that, we mean as a percentage of the income or the amount of resources that a family has. So, of course, if you spend 90% of your income to pay for healthcare insurance, you can say in some sense it's accessible, but in another sense, it certainly isn't. Fourth, the health insurance strategy should be affordable and sustainable, not just for families and individuals, but for society. Almost no one says we should allow the economy to go bust. It needs to find a way to both make it affordable for individuals, but also to be sustainable over time for society. And then fifth, health insurance should enhance the health and well-being by promoting access to high-quality care that's effective, efficient, safe, timely, patient-centered, and equitable. So from the sources that I read, if you will poll someone, aside from a divisive sort of discussion where people say things they don't really mean just to perhaps get a reaction or to oppose someone else's thinking about it, sort of in a sane, civil moment, almost everybody who surveyed typically would say these are five outcomes that we should strive for within the United States for our citizens. But of course the question is, how do we reach these agreed upon goals and outcomes? And that's where the debate begins. Well, it's not news to you that back March 23rd, 2010, President Obama signed into law a very significant health care bill that was entitled the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. We'll just call it PPACA. And then this was followed almost immediately, about a week later, by the Health Care and Education Reconciliation Act of 2010, a number of amendments to that original health care bill. And although this is probably new to you, just so we're all on the same page, I just want to very briefly review a couple of the key provisions that are a part of those two health care bills. The first is that insurers would be required to offer the same premium to all applicants, regardless of age, gender, or geographical location. So some of that's new. At the current time, until that law was passed, it would be possible to offer premiums that would be different based on some of those criteria, and that would no longer be possible. Secondly, persons could not be denied access to comprehensive health coverage based on pre-existing conditions or health status, and persons could not be removed from a plan if he or she got sick. And again, that's a movement forward in the sense of there would be no ability to deny someone just based on their previous health history to participate in an insurance plan. Thirdly, a shared responsibility mandate, commonly called the individual mandate, requires that all persons who are not currently covered by a health care plan will be required to purchase an approved private insurance policy or pay a penalty. There are a few exceptions, but they're relatively minor. So that was one of the big pieces that certainly drew a large part of the reaction. But it would be not possible to not pay for insurance or not pay for a penalty. One would have to pick between the two. Fourth, Medicaid eligibility in the original law would have been expanded to include all individuals and all families with incomes up to 133% of the poverty level. And we'll talk later, that was one that did not survive the Supreme Court scrutiny. So that part of the original policy was not found to be constitutional. Fifth, health insurance exchanges would be established by each state and would commence offering a marketplace where individuals and small businesses would be able to compare and contrast and purchase policies. So they would be set up on the state level and they would become something a commerce of insurance policies, typically for individuals, for families, or for small businesses to provide a competitive market at that level. Fourth, low-income persons and families above the Medicaid level up to 400% of the poverty level would be eligible for A, tax credits, and B, federal subsidies on a sliding scale if they choose to purchase insurance via an exchange. And also importantly, out-of-pocket expenses would be capped. So this would provide an ability for people who are above the poverty level, but still not greatly above the poverty level, to have some subsidies from the government to be able to increase their ability to afford. And what that really means is so that the percentage of their income would stay within a particular limit. So it wouldn't be too high a percentage of their income that would have to be devoted to purchasing insurance. And then lastly, minimum standards for health insurance policies would be established, and annual and lifetime coverage caps would be banned. Now, you all know in the multi-$1,000 document, these 5 or 6 points don't do it. But these seem to be some of the main points that generated conversation and controversy, and again, seem to be sort of a summary of some of what was new or some would be unique in terms of what we had prior to the passing of those laws. Now, the passing of that legislation doesn't in our society mean sort of the issue settled, and now we'll move forward with implementation. Almost before the ink was dry on the signatures of these new laws, legal actions were filed, and courts began to review the different components of these laws. Some of the courts reviewed the whole law, some reviewed components, but by the time, in a fairly short time, a majority of the states and numerous organizations and individuals filed actions in federal court challenging the constitutionality of some pieces of the PPACA. By January of this year, 2 of 4 appellate courts upheld the basic structure of the new laws. A third found the individual mandate to be unconstitutional. And a fourth said that the Federal Anti-Injunction Act prevents the issue from even being decided upon until 2015, when taxpayers would begin paying penalties. So their basic finding was, we can't rule on it until 2015 when the penalties start to roll. So already in the initial court reviews, there was a great deal of diversity in how the constitutionality of the law was reviewed. Of course, leading up then to the Supreme Court in March of this year, listening to 6 hours of oral arguments at the end of June, resulting in the now famous split decision to uphold much of the original law, including the controversial individual mandate. Although, as I mentioned before, it was decided that the states, and not this federal law, but the states would be allowed to decide whether or not to expand their Medicaid programs to cover individuals up to 133% of the poverty level. And I'm sure you heard right after that, a number of states went very publicly and quickly on record that that was just never going to happen within their states. So, again, that was one piece of the law that has not survived the constitutional review. So, some would say, now the Supreme Court's ruled, so things have pretty much been settled. Now it's time to move on to implementation. But, obviously, if you listen to enough news, that thought lasted about 5 or 10 minutes after the Supreme Court ruling, and already actions were taken to begin to move, to continue to wrestle with the health care reform legislation. Within less than a month after the Supreme Court decision, the House of Representatives voted 244 to 185, so 244 in favor of and 185 against repealing the full health care law in what was largely a symbolic display of opposition, because that wasn't a large enough percentage. But it still showed that the majority of the House had voted to repeal in its entirety the health care law. And in fact, this symbolic vote represented the 33rd vote in Congress to repeal the law or eliminate funding for the original law since it was first signed back in 2010. And probably some of you heard the amounts of money, the millions that it's cost for these different votes being taken to either dismantle parts or the entirety of the health care law. And in addition, John Boehner, the House Speaker, went on public record as saying, quote, we're resolved to have this law go away, and we're doing everything we can to stop it. So a person in a very powerful position communicating to the American public that although the law survived Supreme Court review, there was a commitment of a large number of people for this law to be repealed in its entirety. So there's a lot here to take in. And the question I want to ask you today is, where do you stand on that health care law? You can have that discussion. I'm sure that would be a good rowdy one. But I'm interested in a little bit of a different direction. It's what's a person of faith supposed to, what resources, what tools does a person of faith have to try to make some sense? How should we feel about and weigh the merits of PPACA, for example, or the other healthcare laws and proposals that are going to come as over the next couple of years, certainly going to come in rapid-fire fashion? How is it that we can wrap our minds around how can faith play some role in trying to evaluate and set up some criteria for what we're going to decide to advocate for or what we think is going to be appropriate and helpful for our society? So how does a Christian faithfully live out God's call for justice in our world as it applies to the provision of health care in our society? And how can social workers tap the resources of their faith and spirituality to inform their thinking about healthcare reform? So in today's session, and it's not a long session, we're basically going to talk about three basic principles that I believe are readily applicable to at least the broad parameters of healthcare policy and implementation from the Judeo-Christian tradition. That is, principles on which I believe that many, or at least most people of faith in social work, even politically diverse people of faith, would agree on these sort of broad principles as a way of trying to evaluate healthcare reform. Now, of course, that doesn't mean we'll all agree. It's not meant to be the Judeo-Christian criteria for evaluating healthcare or any policy. But hopefully it's a meaningful start, and I hope that you can give me some feedback about whether you think, in fact, that it is. So that's what I want to switch gears to. After I raise one objection that often comes up sort of at this point in the discussion. And so often someone will say, well, we're living in a diverse and pluralistic society. You know, Rick, is it even fair game for a person to draw on or reference their own personal, spiritual, moral, or religious beliefs and values when they enter the public forum to discuss public policies that impact our increasingly diverse society? And you note that you will be in discussions where people will say, if that's your religious point of view, there is no room for it here. This is a political discussion. We're a pluralistic society. It's not a religious discussion. Please check those values or those beliefs at the door so we can engage in real, you know, advocacy or real public policy. So I just want to talk a little bit about that question, because I don't think that that's an appropriate or fair critique. So I want to give you some reasons why I think when someone says that, you have some rights to say, wait a minute, hold on. Let's think about what you're asking me to do. Let's talk a little bit about that. So while I believe we should always be exceptionally and extraordinarily respectful and civil and open-minded and listening to other people's point of views when we discuss public policies, I don't want to give myself or anyone license to beat people over the heads with sort of my view of the world, especially with regard to persons who have different viewpoints than I do. I'd much rather they came away from a discussion feeling like I treated them extremely well than that I beat them in the discussion. It's really not about that. However, being respectful and civil and open-minded and really listening to what the other person has to say, being willing maybe to change if they could persuade you, is very different than saying that you have to check your personal or moral or religious beliefs at the door when we enter the public forum. And I want to say this for three reasons. The first is, at least all the people that I've ever met are moral, valuing beings at their core. And even if I bought the argument that I should leave everything that I believe and value at the door to have a discussion, I just don't know any people who can do that. I just don't think it's possible to bracket who we are, what forms a crucial part of our self-identities, to leave that out when we have discussion about things that impact ourselves and other people and human beings. I think one of the valuable contributions of the post-Enlightenment world is that it's really been clearly made that none of us can step outside completely of what we believe and who we are. To require people to do that as a condition of being part of the public conversation would be seriously misguided, because in fact it would disqualify anyone from having a conversation. Because if you might want me to check my religious beliefs at the door, I should probably be able to ask you to check your atheistic beliefs at the door, or your whatever they might be. But we all are people that come with our stuff, And I think the key is to be able to use it respectfully and honestly, and not to check at the door. So one of the responses I had to someone who says, check it at the door, is, well, I can't do that, but even if I could, I don't think you can either. So that's really not a serious... I take it you don't like the beliefs that I'm bringing to the table, but that's very different than saying I can and I should keep that out of the conversation. So that's one thing that I would say. A second is, even if it was possible to do that, and I don't think it is, even if it was possible, would it be desirable to do so? For it to take out the core parts of what I believe and value, the sort of the animating role they play in who I am and why I am a social worker and why I advocate for people in need, if you take that away and you ask me to leave that out of conversation, there really isn't much motivation left for me to advocate, or there would be for the other person. So to take away sort of the core of who we are and what we believe, even if we could do it, that's usually the stuff that makes us really good social workers and really good compassionate carer for other people. So to ask us to take that away, in essence, makes it a conversation that is no longer about the thing that we're most passionate about and makes us who we are. The third thing I would say is the plain fact is that really at every significant policy decision point in our country's history, slavery, women's suffrage, more recently civil rights, there are countless examples we could draw on, but moral and civil values and religious values have always been a crucial part of the policy debate in our country. Why suddenly should this indicate that even though it's played a useful, effective role in the past, suddenly we should ask to withdraw anything about what we believe as valuing moral people in the discussion? And so if it was useful during those discussions about slavery and women's suffrage and civil rights, all the more so that we have some history that we can draw on to say the inclusion of that in a respectful way actually is going to add important depth and value to the discussion, and so should be allowed. So I think the responsible answer is asking me to check my religious beliefs and values at the door really isn't a responsible request. Our obligation is not to check them at the door, but to handle them in a way that, again, is thoughtful and respectful and civil and open to dialogue and discussion. Again, that's different than asking to keep them out altogether. So, assuming that the person has agreed that you may come to the public forum, and even if they haven't, because again, my argument is, if you're going to say anything at all, they're going to be informed by who you are at your core. I'd like to move on and talk about three basic principles from the Judeo-Christian tradition that I believe are applicable to this particular debate. That is, principles that I think can, broadly speaking, act as lenses that we can use to help us analyze and evaluate and weigh the merits of and the merits against any healthcare law or policy that we'll have before us. Now, partly because I'm speaking at a Catholic university, although not entirely, but partly because I've chosen to express these principles in language drawn from Catholic social teaching. But that's only partly. I just think that Catholic social teaching says them so much more in-depth and well-resourced than many of our other traditions. But I would say that the things I'm going to say are probably deeply inbred in most of our religious traditions, and not just the Christian traditions, but these represent much of what's strongest about many of our faith and spirituality traditions all over the world from all of time. So although I'm going to use some language from Catholic social teaching, I hope if you're not Catholic, like I'm not, you'll probably pretty quickly be able to say, oh, that sounds like the Heidelberg Catholic, or whatever your particular denominational background, because I think there's some of the real fundamentals of what it means to be a religious person, a person of faith. Definitely Christian, because that's, I know, and that's my experience, but from what I know of my friends who are Jewish and Muslim, they would say that these are principles that resonate very deeply with who they are and with where they come from. So, here are the three principles, and then after this, we're going to have some discussion about, for you, does this say anything about how you look at healthcare reform and legislation? So, the first is the principle, which is a commitment to the dignity and worth of all human persons and the rights that flow from the commitment to that viewpoint. The sacred dignity of the human person is rooted in the belief that all people are created in God's image. And because of that, just because of that, regardless of what they've done, just because of being created in that image, they have an inherent, undeniable dignity and worth. Christian Smith defines dignity as an inherent worth of immeasurable value that is deserving of certain appropriate responses, in particular respect, love, and justice. One important implication of this commitment is by virtue of a person having dignity and worth, is that every person has an analogous right, a fundamental right to life, as well as a right to those things required for human decency, including things like food and clothing, shelter, employment, education, and health care. Human dignity can only be protected if these human rights are protected as they apply to each of us, and to our families, and to our larger society. So we can't have this sort of abstract belief of people being of dignity and worth unless we tease out what does that mean. It means that they also need to have those things that ensure that they can live lives worthy of the dignity that that they deserve. One additional implication of this commitment is that maximizing persons' chances to live safe and healthy and productive lives is a concrete way to actually affirm their dignity, not at a theoretical level, but at a personal level, and to enable them the opportunity to flourish. Because saying that someone has dignity and worth without a commitment to enabling them to flourish, to be the most they possibly could be, really denies that they have the dignity and worth that we've just affirmed. We need to also be committed to helping them to flourish, and not just as individuals, but as families, as communities, and as a full society. And in turn, through that flourishing, to make their contribution to the healing and redemption and flourishing of the world around us. So the unpacking of dignity and worth has a lot of different layers. And some of those layers are the rights that people have by virtue of that dignity to be treated in certain ways. And some of that has to do with treating them in ways so that they can flourish and in turn make society better, and that be their contribution to society as well. So that's sort of that first principle, is a robust commitment to the dignity and worth of all persons. And what does that say about what we think about healthcare reform? A second principle is a commitment to a biblical understanding of what does it mean to be our brother's keeper, our brother's and our sister's keeper. A commitment to, in Catholic social teaching, the principle of solidarity. The familiar question that was posed by Cain to God, by Cain to God at the dawn of humanity, when God, knowing that Cain had murdered his brother Abel, asked Cain the infamous question. What question did God ask of Cain? Where is your brother? And Cain answered God,
am I my brother's keeper?
From my understanding of theology, much of the rest of Scripture is the unfolding from Genesis to Revelation that provides an answer to that question with a resounding yes. We are our brothers and our sisters' keepers. We're to love and care for and nurture and sacrifice ourselves for each other. And the reason that that would make sense is because I'll show you an example of what it would mean to be a brother's or sister's keeper. I will live a life, and that's the life that we see Jesus live, of caring for and protecting and nurturing and ultimately sacrificing. And so God's response to that question, am I my brother's keeper, isn't just to say verbally yes, although that would be appropriate, but also to say, let me show you what it means to be my brother and my sister's keeper, and then the life of Jesus to come and to care for and to give an ultimate sacrifice for folks. That's what solidarity means. That's what being our brothers and sisters' keeper ultimately means. So this principle of solidarity from Catholic social teaching emphasizes that each of us has a responsibility not just for ourselves, but for each other, of equal weight. Caring for another is every bit as important as it is for caring for ourselves. Still building on the dignity and the worth of human persons, solidarity is a firm and persevering commitment to the common good, recognizing that our flourishing, which we all have a stake in, is bound to the flourishing of our brothers and sisters across the street, across the state, across the country, and across the globe. So this understanding of being our brother's keepers is that the cycle means only in doing that can we actually have care for ourselves and society at large done. Without that responsibility, things degenerate into each person only being for him or herself. Being our brother's keeper is grounded in Judeo-Christian belief that our second highest obligation is that we have as human beings, after loving God with all of our heart and our strength, is to love our neighbors as we love ourselves. Protecting and nurturing the well-being, the social, spiritual, emotional, and physical well-being, which includes a person's health, of every person made in God's image, is a profound individual and communal responsibility for people of faith. So again, the second principle is fleshing out what does it mean to be our brother's and our sister's keeper. How did God demonstrate what that looked like, and how do we then mirror that care for our brothers and sisters in the way we live out our common lives? The third principle, commitment to identify with the poor and the vulnerable in our communities and in our world. Faith calls us to identify with the least among us, and as such, to have special or preferential concern for people who are poor, vulnerable, and marginalized. All the more so because many times they're not able to have what they need to sustain and to flourish. Pope John Paul II, echoing the message of so many of the Old Testament prophets, emphasized that the measure for just society is how it treats its most vulnerable members. Any society can treat an elite few well, but a real measure of the stuff of any society is how well it treats those who struggle and are on the margins. As a result, people who are poor deserve our first consideration when reflecting on the social conditions of society, how we should act for justice to promote human dignity and common good in our society. Put another way, deprivation of the poor in society wounds not just the poor, it wounds the whole community. And the whole community can only be healthy if its members give special attention to those who are poor and at the margins. So again, although there's a reason to be altruistic and to reach out to those who are poor, following the model that Jesus gave us, in doing that is the only real ability for the community itself to be whole and to flourish. And so without that, again, communities will stagnate. So these are three principles from the Judeo-Christian tradition. And for those of you who aren't Catholic, I hope you heard resonating many of the things that you hear in sermons, like the one that Jack gives regularly. The kinds of things that really lay at the sort of basis of what it is that our faith stands for. And I want to argue that those are the kinds of commitments that can properly function as lenses or filters through which we view and analyze and weigh the healthcare policies and decisions that are in front of us now, and that will lie ahead of us in the future. Put another way, when you're evaluating the healthcare legislation, the TPACA, or the newest version that's going to come out when an attempt is made to take the TPACA out, a key question is, to what extent does the TPACA or the competitor, how good a job does it do compared to other policies? Which does a better job of ensuring these commitments to ensuring the dignity and right of people in our society, solidarity, being our brothers and our sisters' keeper, and identifying with the poor and the vulnerable? Now, this is not the only relevant lens through which we look at healthcare policy. There are other relevant things like cost and sustainability over time. So I'm not saying, armed with these three principles, we will probably pretty simply decide what the healthcare policy should be and move on. But it's a really important part of the evaluation process. And if our impulse is that what we believe in our bones needs to have some impact on how we do this thing called policy advocacy and policy debate, that finding principles like these and finding ways to use them as criteria for our evaluation becomes a part of thinking Christianly, thinking through the eyes of faith, which, again, for many of us is a commitment to do that as faithfully as we can.
Thank you for joining us today for NACSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. We hope you found today's session useful and that it will support your efforts to thoughtfully integrate Christian faith and social work practice. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NACSW's activities and events, including NACSW's upcoming convention in the fall, our quarterly audio conference workshops that we offer at no cost to NACSW members, and which includes free CEUs accredited by the Association of Social Work Boards, our online continuing education program, and access to dozens of archived podcasts from the members section of our website. Also, we invite you to join NACSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NACSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening in today to our podcast session today.